This is Mayo Clinic Radio, the only show that gives you the chance to ask your questions to Mayo Clinic experts. We'll take you beyond the headlines to explain what developments in medicine mean to you. Join the conversation by phone, Twitter, Facebook, or radio.mayoclinic.org. Now, with this week's program, here are your hosts, Dr. Tom Shives and Tracy McRae.
From the Mayo Clinic, Rochester, Minnesota campus, I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McRae.
Welcome, everyone, to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Well, Tracy, 75 years ago this summer, Lou Gehrig gave his farewell speech at Yankee Stadium, unfortunately having been diagnosed with amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, or ALS, a few months earlier at the Mayo Clinic right here in Rochester, Minnesota. The disease is now often referred to as Lou Gehrig's disease. He's probably the most famous person who has had it. Mm-hmm. He was diagnosed at age 36 and lived for about 2 years, died 2 years later. And despite the passing of some 75 years, there is still no cure for this disease or even very effective treatment for ALS.
Yes, today on Mayo Clinic Radio, we'll meet one of the world's experts on ALS, Dr. Anthony Windebank. And you know, he has taken the ice bucket challenge.
He and everybody else.
That's right.
What a great event.
We'll talk about that ice bucket challenge. We'll also talk about the risk factors of ALS and who's more likely to get this disease. We'll talk about how they make the diagnosis and find out what treatments are available and what complications might ultimately lead to the person's demise. Plus, we'll also talk with Dr. Windebank about a new treatment with stem cells that will hopefully improve a patient's survival. Yes.
Yeah, we hope so. Great topic. But first, have you heard about this? You know, it's not a house call, but it's sort of close. It's a kiosk call.
Okay.
It's a health spot station that's in a kiosk that's about the size of a walk-in closet. And you go in there and you tell them what your symptoms are and you're talking to a health care provider. Pretty interesting concept. Joining us by telephone is Dr. Mark Schotte from the Mayo Clinic Health System in Austin, Minnesota. Dr. Schotte, welcome. Good to have you on the program.
Thanks for asking me.
So tell us about the kiosk.
Well, the kiosk is it's really the next step in online type of non-patient visit, but it's a high-quality two-way interaction between a physician and a patient in an enclosed kiosk, both video and audio. And what really separates this is not only is there video and audio, but there's also devices that the patient uses or is instructed to use to take their blood pressure, to look in their ear, to listen to their heart and lungs, to look at skin lesions. So it's a very highly interactive way to receive health care.
Well, then what happens? You say, oh, you're okay, don't worry about it, you got a cold, or, you know, you need to come in and see somebody. Or how does that, what happens? What's the ultimate conclusion?
The diagnoses that are best treated at one of these kiosks are the similar things that you would go to an express care or an urgent care for.
Sure.
And so most of the time then you end up with a diagnosis and then a prescription, if you need antibiotics, can be sent to the kiosk or sent to your pharmacy of choice. Right. All of the medical information that's gained in there then is seamlessly transmitted to the patient's Mayo Clinic electronic record, so it's available for all their other healthcare team.
It's a great idea, as far as I'm concerned, the mother of a couple of kids, because, you know, trying to find a spot that's available for a quick call in or maybe a quick in just to see the doctor, this is an option that you don't have to make all those appointments. You don't have to worry about parking.
Right. They're typically located in areas where you typically wouldn't find healthcare like this for this kind of quality. And so the convenience is a big factor. They're also going to be priced so that the visit is less than an urgent care visit or an emergency room visit. So there's also some value to that as well, but it does maintain the quality that patients expect.
What about somebody with chest pain, for example? Like, can you hook them up and do an EKG and say, you know, you need to call 911 or you need to get to the hospital?
No, that's a great question. When you first, either online or if you show up at the kiosk without an appointment, you're walked through a series of questions, and quickly, depending on how you answer the questions, you will be told that this is not an appropriate venue for what you have, and then you should go to emergency room or some higher level of care.
So what are the most common things that you're seeing?
What it's really good for is sore throats, earaches, upper respiratory infections, skin rashes, allergies, urinary tract infections. Again, those type of those type of ailments that most people go to an express care for. The other part of it is where we can put them. If you could imagine one being placed in a nursing home, so that nursing home patients don't have to be transported to the clinic to be seen, they can be seen where they are.
Wow. Yeah, that's exactly what I was going to ask. Where do you see these being utilized? You know, the top places that they would go. So a nursing home, where else?
Nursing home would be one. And then we're currently speaking with some employers and school districts around the Austin area to place them into their workplaces or very near to the workplaces. And if you could imagine at a school, if you had one in a school, teachers and students could access it without having to leave the building, which means then the school district doesn't have to hire substitutes for a half day when the teacher is gone. So it should increase the productivity of the employees as well.
So who mans it? I mean, is there a physician on the other end who's watching and looking at you?
Right. So there's board-certified physicians, some nurse practitioners, and physician assistants. And the beauty of it is that provider can be anywhere, literally anywhere in the world.
So the one that you have in Austin, Minnesota, that is the only one currently, correct?
That is currently the only one. We're using it as a pilot project, and we worked with our Mayo Clinic colleagues to make sure that the medical information was completely secure and that we've gone through our safety protocols and disinfection protocols. And so now we're rolling it out as a pilot. We plan to start using it to see our own employees in Austin over the next few weeks. And again, as a pilot, we're just hoping to learn more about it and the best way that we can use it into the future.
And you are about ready for expansion, it sounds like.
Yes, we're hoping that as we get into the first quarter of next year, we'll have a couple of other business partners in the Austin area that want to try it with some of their employees as well.
Wow. Dr. Mark Schoede, thanks so much for being with us. Exciting concept. I hope it works.
Thanks for asking me. Have a great day.
You bet. Well, it's time for a short break. Coming up, we will talk with neurologist and ALS expert Dr. Anthony Windebank, Mayo Clinic, Rochester. Plus, myth or matter of fact, football players are at greatest risk for ALS. Myth or matter of fact?
We'll get the answer coming up. And right after the news at the bottom of the hour, we'll take your questions on ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease, at 507-282-1234. You can also tweet us at any time, hashtag Mayo Clinic Radio. We'll be back right after this.
Welcome back to Mayo Clinic Radio. Dr. Tom Shives along with Tracy McRae and this week's guest, Mayo Clinic Rochester, Minnesota neurologist and ALS expert, Dr. Anthony Windebank. Dr. Windebank, so good to have you on the program.
Thank you very much for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Isn't it interesting? 75 years ago this past summer, Lou Gehrig was diagnosed with ALS, and he was probably the most famous patient that you have seen here, although you have seen a number of famous patients. Tell us a little bit about Lou Gehrig and when he was diagnosed and how you did it.
Yep, that was, of course...
Okay, you didn't do it.
It wasn't me personally. Lou Gehrig started to notice the season before, towards the end of, I think it was the 36 season or 37 season, that he was just beginning to slow down a little bit. And... as the season went on, he thought it was just because he was getting older.
Sure.
Even though he was just in his mid-30s.
Doesn't matter. It's the first time he'd ever gotten older.
That's right.
You don't know any better.
And then during the winter, he really started to notice problems. And then he went to spring training. And during spring training, he was really having a hard time running the bases. And he... then went on, started the season, and in the first couple of games, he just realized there was something terribly wrong. He couldn't catch the ball. He couldn't move fast enough. So he benched himself. And
about in April or May, he came here?
Yep, exactly. Okay. He benched himself, and then between his wife and the manager of the Yankees, they had contacts at the Mayo Clinic, and he came... and originally to see Dr. Mayo, but then was rapidly referred to his neurology colleague, Dr. Waltman, and he made the diagnosis very quickly.
Well, and the diagnosis is pretty much based on examination of the patient and history, right?
At that time it was, yes. That was in the days before we had more sophisticated electrophysiological diagnostic tests. So it was based entirely on the history and the examination. And that's still the core of what we do now.
So was it April or May that he was diagnosed?
I think it was April.
Okay. So, and then July is when he made his speech and retired.
Yes.
So it was... He just had a short time to process what was going to be happening to him.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And it was July 4th, actually, at Yankee Stadium. They had a special day for Lou Gehrig to retire, mm-hmm. and he gave his luckiest man alive speech.
Right. And did he go back and play at all anymore, or did he just come that day and make his speech?
No, that was the end. Mm-hmm. He then, city of New York actually found him a position as a probation officer, mm-hmm. because he liked working with young people. And he did that for a while, mm-hmm. And then died quite soon afterwards.
So he lived about 2 years after his diagnosis, is
exactly.
that correct? What is this disease? What happens?
It's a disorder that affects the nerve cells that control your muscles, and it's particularly the voluntary muscles. So it's when you move a finger, when you talk, when you walk, all of those muscles in your body are controlled by nerves that are in your spinal cord and in your brain, and those nerve cells start to die prematurely. And it's that premature loss of those nerve cells that leads to the progressive weakness. And then ultimately, depending on the muscles that are affected, unfortunately, the breathing muscles can be affected.
So that is what is the end then, is that they can't breathe anymore?
That's exactly what happens.
And for Lou Gehrig, he was, we were saying beforehand, he was textbook. Because it's, your symptom shows up and then... Usually it's about a 2 year window, but that's not the case at all for all patients.
No, that's absolutely right. It can be quite variable. That's the textbook average case. But some patients, it can be very long lasting. Dr. Mulder, who was a researcher here at Mayo Clinic, did some studies looking at large groups of patients with ALS and found that about 5 to 10% would survive for more than 20 years.
Wow.
And we don't have any idea, really, or do we have an idea why these brain cells start to die?
We don't. It's clear that there are genetic factors involved in some cases. About 5 to 10% of patients, it's actually a familial disease. Mm. That is, other relatives have it, and it runs through the family. And in many of those cases, you can actually identify specific genes that are related to the disease. But also in people with what's called sporadic ALS, which means it's not a family disease, it just comes out of the blue. In those people, there's more and more genetic abnormalities or predispositions being identified.
One of the myths or matter of fact that we talked about when I was looking online, I had never heard before, and that was that football players are at a greatest risk for ALS. Mm-hmm. Is that a myth or is that a fact?
It's a myth.
Where does that even come from, first of all?
Well, it probably started even, it wasn't just football players, it was professional sports players.
Okay.
So it was football and baseball players. And this is probably going back 15 to 20 years. There seemed to be a cluster of cases in California around professional football teams. And so there was a lot of investigation was done. One of the thoughts was, well, maybe it's something that is used on the field.
Sure.
And one of the things that came under suspicion was something called milorganite. So that milorganite is a product from the Milwaukee public sewer system.
Wow.
Where they process and sterilize the waste material and turn it into a fertilizer that's still used. It's very good for roses. My wife uses it.
And she doesn't have ALS.
No. So there were actually quite a lot of studies done. Mayo Clinic was involved in that. Dr. Len Kurland, who was one of the great neuroepidemiologists, mm-hmm. who study populations of people, did studies and demonstrated that, no, there wasn't any relationship.
There is not a link at all?
No.
Okay.
So a definite genetic abnormality in 5 to 10% of patients, and you assume that there's probably a genetic abnormality in the others that has not been detected or discovered?
It's almost certain that the disease is something to do with a person's genetic makeup and then something in the environment.
And I've seen it suggested that it may be more common in people who smoke, people who have been exposed to lead, and also people in the military. Is that right?
All very good questions. The no relationship to smoking, accidents, anything like that. Occupations, there's been a lot of interest over the years, and there's a small increase, probably, in people who have occupations that expose them to heavy metals, things like batteries, cadmium, lead, things like that. But it's if it's an effect at all, it's very, very small. The military effect was a very interesting one. There were some studies done after the Gulf War, which suggested that there was, again, a very slight but definite increase in people who were exposed or took part in active service in the Gulf Wars. One of the problems of those kind of associations is that once you start to ask the question,
sure,
you start to find associations, and people are thinking much more intensely about, you know, what have I been exposed to, mm-hmm, and such. And it's very difficult to control for that. So, yes, there may be some clues there, but it's not clear what they mean.
And men more likely than women to get ALS?
Slightly more, yes. It's about 1.5 times more likely than women.
And middle-aged, like 30s and 40s, more than any other age group?
It's actually an age-related disorder. So the age is the biggest risk factor.
Right.
The older you get, the more likely you are to get it.
But the videos that I've seen, the things that I've been preparing for this, are all people, and maybe they just make the best subjects for interview, that seem to be my age, seem to be in their 40s.
I think that's right. I think exactly what you say, that when it hits young people like Lou Gehrig,
It's
a bigger deal. Mm.
So tell us a little bit about Heritage Days, the 150th anniversary of the Mayo Clinic. And I think as part of Heritage Days, you had an opportunity to talk about ALS and specifically Lou Gehrig.
Absolutely, yes. It was. There were two things that happened really this year. There was the 75th anniversary of his Luckiest Man Alive speech, and then the 150th anniversary of Mayo Clinic. We had the opportunity to put on a public forum about that, where we talked about the history, Lou Gehrig's history with Mayo Clinic, and then have a question and answer session with the public.
Did he make multiple visits to Mayo?
He did. He actually became quite friendly, especially with the neurologist who was and his family, who was looking after him. When he came to Mayo Clinic, he'd come and he'd spend typically 2 or 3 days here. And because he was such a well-known figure, he'd actually be out in the community. He would visit people. He visited one of the grocery stores where the butcher was a past professional baseball player.
He used to play ball with them.
That's right.
I remember hearing about that. That's one of the odd things about Mayo Clinic in the city of Rochester, yeah, is that there are still people here who you could run into that treated him, that worked, you know, that were his care team.
Yeah, very much so. In fact, the son of the neurologist who looked after Lou Gehrig, mm-hmm, visited us a while ago and remembers very well when he was a child and Lou Gehrig visiting and what a nice guy he was.
Hmm.
You mentioned before the program a book called The Luckiest Man that you think is excellent.
By Jonathan Eig, yes, it's an excellent book. Absolutely.
And I'm sure there have been several books written about Lou Gehrig. This you think is the best one?
I think it's the one that really concentrates on the man and his life, his history. It's just an excellent book.
All right, so we need to talk about how these people present and what you've got for treatment modalities. Mm-hmm. Now, back in Lou Gehrig's day, I presume there was no treatment at all.
It was very interesting because Lou Gehrig was actually in a clinical trial at Mayo.
Yes, that's cool.
In that time, in the late 30s, was the time when many of the vitamins were being discovered. Mm-hmm. And so he was actually, several of them were discovered at Mayo, and he was put in a clinical trial of the vitamins to treat amyotrophic lateral sclerosis.
And probably didn't help much.
Unfortunately not.
Well, and at that point, how much would the physicians know to tell them, here's what your path is probably going to be? I mean, did they have a good grasp of what it was going to be like, or was it still in the discovery phase?
No, the disease had been known for more than 100 years mm-hmm. when Lou Gehrig was diagnosed. So the physicians knew very well what was happening. And it's interesting because there is actually some, I won't say controversy, but there's some discussion around how much Lou Gehrig was told. Mm. Because he, as he talked, and he said it in the Luckiest Man Alive speech, that he... he thought that some people had a good chance of, maybe the disease being stopped. Mm. Although it's very, very clear, and we know from the doctors who were looking after him that he would have been told a very clear picture of what was going to happen.
Well, if he was part of a clinical trial, though, maybe he had a shred of hope that might be something that would help.
I think there's always hope.
Sure.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
All right, ALS is caused by Lyme disease or other infections. Myth or matter of fact?
That's a very good question. It's often asked by our patients, and the answer is no, it's not. Lyme disease can cause neurological problems, and it can cause a disorder with weakness that could look a little bit like ALS, but it's very easy to separate them.
All right, the book is called The Luckiest Man. You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio. Our guest and expert on Lou Gehrig's disease, neurologist Dr. Anthony Windebank.
Coming up, this week's health and medical news with Vivian Williams. Plus, we'll take your phone calls at 507-282-1234. You can also tweet us your questions about ALS at hashtag Mayo Clinic Radio. This is Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network.
Hi, I'm Vivian Williams with headlines from the Mayo Clinic News Network. Obesity increases your risk of certain health issues. That's not new news, but a new Penn Medicine study suggests having a tongue that's fat and large may be a sign of obstructive sleep apnea, or OSA, in obese adults. Earlier studies show tongues have a high percentage of fat, and this study found higher fat deposits in the tongues of OSA patients than those without OSA. They say more research is needed to see if losing weight decreases tongue fat and whether that can help with OSA. This was published in the journal Sleep. Now, do you hate swallowing pills? Well, scientists at the University of Southampton have figured out how to help medication penetrate skin, which could have major implications for how drugs are delivered. They say things called nanoparticles are the way drugs get through skin, and using them to do so means medication can be more concentrated, targeted, and efficient than those delivered through traditional means. The researchers are interested in figuring out how to use what they've learned to develop new ways to deliver drugs through skin. And this was published in the journal Small. And from Mayo Clinic, a new minimally invasive laser-based tool for epilepsy surgery offers a quicker recovery time for patients than major surgery. For more than 50 years, the standard effective treatment for medication-resistant epileptic seizures has been brain surgery. It's very effective, but recovery takes time. This new technique, called thermal laser ablation, involves making a small hole in the skull through which doctors put a catheter that heats and destroys the spot in the brain where seizures happen. Here's Dr. Richard Marsh.
And we can see in real time in the MRI scanner the tissue heating up. And so we can be sure that we're satisfied both that we're destroying the tissue we want to and also that we're staying out of harm's way from adjacent tissue we do not want to injure.
Research is ongoing for this technology. And finally, when it comes to coffee, do you reach for decaf or high test? Researchers from the National Cancer Institute report that drinking decaffeinated coffee may be good for your liver. The study published published in the journal Hepatology shows that higher coffee consumption, no matter how much caffeine is in it, was linked to lower levels of abnormal liver enzymes. This suggests that the chemical compounds in coffee, not the caffeine, may help protect the liver. Now, earlier studies looked at how caffeine affects the liver, and this one suggests that it's not the caffeine that may benefit it, but something else in the coffee. You can expect more studies on this to figure out what that something else is. And that's a look at headlines from the Mayo Clinic News Network. I'm Vivian Williams. You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network.
Welcome back. Information you want from specialists who know. We are on air, online, and also you can catch us on iHeartRadio. You can also listen live to the program by going to our flagship station's website, KROCAM.com. Click Listen Live.
It's time for you to join our conversation. You can contact us by phone at 507-282-1234, or you can tweet us at hashtag Mayo Clinic Radio.
So, Dr. Windebank, let's talk a little bit about the signs and symptoms. The typical patient with ALS comes to see you with what and complaining of what?
Typically, it's with weakness somewhere. So, for example, someone might have noticed some difficulty using their hand, or maybe their foot's dragging a little bit. And initially, they may have thought, well, it's arthritis, or it's a nerve injury or something like that. But then clearly they notice that it's getting worse and maybe spreading to other areas, and that immediately raises the red flags then.
Is this a diagnosis of exclusion? How do you confirm that that's what they have?
It's partly a diagnosis of exclusion, but the first and most important thing is the history of the patient, that it's a typically painless, progressive weakness. And then when you examine the patient, the person, it has a very characteristic appearance, because it's not just the weakness that's present. The muscles may have started to atrophy or to lose muscle bulk, and there's a type of twitching that occurs in the muscles that's characteristic. Now, we all get that. Everyone gets some twitches in their muscles.
But
those become more widespread. And the other characteristic is that it's not only the nerve cells that directly go to the muscles, it's the nerve cells in the brain that control the muscles. Mm. And as they fail, they're called the upper motor neurons, a person's reflexes will start to increase. So the combination of muscle weakness and increased reflexes is clinically diagnostic.
And are there some tests that you can do to help confirm it?
Absolutely. Classically, the test that's most helpful is called electromyography, which is an electrical test on the nerves and muscles, which tells us which muscles are involved and what the characteristics of the nerve damage is. That's very... it's a confirmatory test, and then we exclude. It's very important to exclude other things that might have caused it, like, for example, arthritis in the spinal cord. So often we will do MRIs to make sure there isn't something pressing or damaging the spinal cord. And then there are a number of blood tests to exclude things like Lyme disease and other disorders that we call them ALS mimics. Mm-hmm. That is, that look like ALS but aren't.
Does it affect sensation or just motor function?
Just motor function. If you examine sensation very, very carefully using some sophisticated sensory testing, you can find some very minor abnormalities.
507-282-1234 is our number. We're going to go to Susan, who has a question. Good morning, Susan.
Yes, this is a history thing, which he hasn't mentioned. There was something about in the Vietnam War, it was called Agent Orange or something, where a bunch of the military men got the ALS. And that seemed to me it was something environmental. Do you know anything about that?
Yes, that's a very good question, because there was a lot of discussion about Agent Orange, which was... I mean, just an awful chemical.
That's what it was. Go ahead.
No, it was, it was associated with the development of some forms of nerve damage or neuropathy, but when it was carefully looked at, it was never associated with ALS.
Yeah, because if you take some of the people who ended up with ALS, some of them had exposure to that or to the rose fertilizer on the playing field, but not all of them. And that's a tricky part about epidemiology.
It is, because when you get a serious disease like ALS, you're obviously the first thing you wonder is what caused it.
Sure.
And you start searching for all those things that happened in the months before you developed it. So trauma is another thing that people often associate. Another thing is electrocution. People have received sort of electric shocks for one reason or another,
sure,
at work or whatever. And all of these things, when they're looked at really carefully, they haven't shown an association.
Mm. All right, so you've made the diagnosis. What then happens?
Well, there's a couple of things. The first thing is really to spend a lot of time with the patient and their family explaining the disease. And even though it's a disease with such a poor outlook in the long run, there are lots of things that can be done to help patients with ALS. So here at Mayo Clinic and at many other medical centers, we have kind of integrated multidisciplinary ALS clinics. And these are typically staffed by neurologists, physical therapists, pulmonary specialists, occupational therapists, gastroenterology doctors, so that you can help some of the symptoms as they come along. There are a lot of things that can be done to help. For example, if a person is having a lot of difficulties with swallowing and they're losing weight, not because of the Lou Gehrig's disease, but simply because they can't eat enough, there's a technique called gastrostomy, where you put a little tube into the stomach, which is done under local anesthetic and allows the person to be fed that way. A lot of patients, as things are progressing, will develop some difficulty with breathing, especially at night when they're asleep. And that can make you feel terrible. You get headaches, you feel drowsy all the time. That can be helped by passive or by ventilation, where you wear a mask, like people with sleep apnea. That actually helps your breathing when you're sleeping, and that can make people feel much better.
We have another phone call, 507-282-1234. Lois is on the line. Lois, your sister had ALS?
Yes, she was in her early 70s when she got it. But there's only four of us left out of a large family. But I'm just wondering, what do we survivors have a greater chance of getting it than not?
Good question, Lois. Thank you for your call.
Very good question. It's probably one of the commonest questions we're asked in the clinic. And the answer is no. If you have a family history, you know, your grandmother had it, or you had an aunt as well as your sister, then yes, you would be at increased risk. But having a single relative does not increase your risk. If we look at hundreds of patients with ALS, there's only about 5% have any family contribution.
I want to go back to August, because the Ice Bucket Challenge took over a two-week span in August that was astounding, actually. And I suspect that, one, it was maybe one of the first times that something like that had taken social media had embraced. But two, a lot of people didn't know anything about ALS. And I think that's part of the reason why it was just astoundingly successful. So what, first of all, when you first heard of it, what did you think?
Oh, my goodness. I first heard about it because two of my colleagues who work with us in the ALS clinic, Dr. Sorensen and Dr. Staff, were actually challenged to do it. And they did it at the on behalf of the local ALS Association.
Sure.
And I thought, well, I hope it doesn't get to me.
So it's the idea, if you were not aware of the ALS Bucket Challenge, Where did it even generate from? Where did it begin?
I believe it was an entrepreneur, a young man in California who I think it was a friend or a colleague developed ALS, who started it, and it just exploded.
So the idea was to, you make a donation, you challenge someone else to dump a bucket of ice water on their heads and take a picture of it and post it on social media, and off it went. How much money was raised? And it was the ALS Association that was the beneficiary of all that money.
That's right. The majority of the money went to the ALS Association in this country. It went international. In fact, in this country,
you did
country,
it in Ireland.
I did it in Ireland. That's right. My relatives who challenged me. I was on vacation in Ireland, and so we did it there, my wife and I. But it was being done all over the world, and so in other countries, it went to their national ALS.
Okay.
Organization. But an important thing, typically the ALS Association in this country would raise about $3 million a year to support research. The challenge brought in, I think it's now about $115 million.
For research. So let's talk about research.
Yes.
Because one of the things that we talked at the very beginning of the program were stem cells and how that can hopefully provide some sort of help or for a person's life expectancy. What does stem cells do?
Well, first,
how do you use them?
It's important to understand that there are lots of different kinds of stem cells, and there are two major kinds. There's the kind that everybody knows about that are derived from embryos. Those are called embryonic stem cells. But we can also isolate stem cells of a different type from different parts of your body, your own body. So from the bone marrow and from your adipose tissue or fat tissue. So there are two stem cell trials going on in the U.S. at the moment. There's one going on at Emory University, and that's using embryonic stem cells.
Okay.
Then there's the trial that's going on at Mayo Clinic, which uses stem cells that we get from the patient's own adipose tissue, fat tissue.
Okay, and what do you do with those stem cells?
Okay, so in this trial, the stem cells are isolated from the fat. The person comes in, and we take out under local anesthetic about 2 tablespoons of fat tissue. That goes into our human cell therapy lab. And really the core, the muscle behind the treatment here is the folks in the human cell therapy lab, Dr. Dietz and his colleagues, who then spend about 6 weeks isolating the stem cells from the fat tissue and growing up billions of those cells. The person then comes back in, the patient comes back in 6 weeks later into our clinical research unit, which is at St. Mary's Hospital, and they have a spinal tap, and the cells are injected into the spinal fluid.
Mm.
Now, you asked at the beginning, well, why are we doing this? The stem cells, we don't think those are going to become new nerve cells.
Okay.
But these are cells that whenever you injure any part of your body, those cells will be mobilized from your bone marrow or from your fat, and they will go to the site of the injury. And
to repair?
Yeah, they're repair and healing cells. But they don't go into the nervous system. The nervous system is kind of, the brain is protected from letting things in. So we're kind of bypassing that and taking these cells that we know are repairing cells and putting them into the nervous system.
Pretty amazing. Because there's not very good treatment for ALS even today, even though we've known about this disease for 175 years, right?
Absolutely. I think there have been more than 30 drug trials, several of them conducted at Mayo, that have been negative.
During the commercial break, though, you said that 20 years ago, everyone that was associated with ALS was so excited because you figured out that there was that genetic component and you thought, oh, now we know the answer.
Absolutely. It's a little more than 20 years ago. The major gene, or one of the main genes that is responsible for the familial, that small number of familial cases, was identified. And everyone in the field thought, okay, it's just a matter of time before that provides the answer. And a lot of treatments based on understanding what that gene does were initiated, and unfortunately so far all of them have failed.
So although you're figuring out a little bit more all the time about the genetics component of it, it has not translated into treating patients?
That's right. There is one drug that's approved, FDA approved, for treating ALS, which is called Riluzol or Rilutec, which is based on this kind of understanding of the mechanism, which in clinical trials was shown to prolong life by about 2 to 3 months.
What is the average survival now, and what is it compared to 75 years ago when Lou Gehrig was diagnosed?
One of the things we've done at Mayo Clinic is to study the incidence of the disease in the population, in a very stable population in Minnesota over a long period of time. And it hasn't, the incidence of the disease and the survival hasn't changed at all in the last 75 years. The average time from your first symptom, kind of in retrospect, to making the diagnosis is about 6 to 8 months. And the average survival from diagnosis to passing on is 22 months.
Wow.
And that has not changed.
Hmm. Again, emphasizing that it's a variable disease.
Sure.
And some patients will survive a very long time. But if we take that median, it's 22 months.
Wow. Is there any way to predict how long someone might survive?
You can estimate, because the way it starts and the way it progresses in the first 6 months to 12 months is a kind of indicator of how it will progress in the future. So if somebody's had symptoms for 3 or 4 years and you make the diagnosis, and they're still very functional, you know that's going to be one of those people who will survive a very long time.
So you said there's the stem cell research that's going on in 2 locations, mm-hmm. one of them being Mayo Clinic. And is there any other research that's going on to help patients?
There are a number of other drug trials that
are
active. If people are interested in finding out what trials are active, there's a website which is called clinicaltrials.gov. And every clinical trial that's going on in the U.S. and every clinical trial that actually worldwide would ever want to produce a product to be used in the U.S. has to be registered there before they start the trial. So that's a very good source.
What about the initial results from this stem cell trial? Encouraging?
They're encouraging because what we're doing at the moment is a safety study. And so far, it seems that the cells are safe. So this safety study is designed where the first group of patients, 5 patients, received a dose of cells. The next 5 patients received a bigger dose of cells. The next 5 actually received the bigger dose and then a second dose a month later. The next group, which we've just finished, received a even higher dose.
All right, neurologist and ALS expert Dr. Anthony Windebank. By the way, the couple of books that we mentioned that if you want to read about people who have had this, one is called The Luckiest Man and the other Caddy for Life. Dr. Windebank, thanks so much for being with us.
It's been a real pleasure. Thank you.
You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Coming up, we'll tell you about next week's program. Stay with us. Welcome back to Mayo Clinic Radio. Next week, the men take over. Men's Health Week on Mayo Clinic Radio. Who are we going to talk with?
Well, this is an interesting program because there is a new men's health clinic at the Scottsdale, Arizona location of Mayo Clinic. And so Dr. Jason Jameson is going to be joining us. He's a urologist, and heart specialist Dr. David Simper. Both will be calling in. For some reason, they don't want to come to Minnesota this program.
Well, you know, it freeze warning. It froze last night. I don't blame them. They were going to come, but then they found out how cold it is.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of things to consider when
so
it comes
to
men's health.
So what do you want to know health? About the man? Well, yeah, the male.
Well, one of the things I'm most curious about is why men don't take care of themselves. There is this whole thing that unless the woman makes the appointment or takes them in, they don't want to cover these things themselves. So the fact that the men's health clinic is going to try to address that, I think, is very interesting.
Well, you do realize, though, that part of the reason that men get as good a health care as they do is because of their spouse.
Exactly.
However, if the man complains of chest pain, the wife will say, call 911, you got to get in there. If she's having chest pain, she'll say, oh, I think it's indigestion, I'll sit here for a while and,
there's
dead
a
on
lot,
arrival.
Yeah, there's a lot to cover. Low testosterone, endocrine issues, prostate health. We'll talk about as much men's health as we can squeeze into one program, and we hope that you'll join us for that. For more information on topics discussed on today's program, please visit our website, radio.mayoclinic.org, where you can access a podcast of today's program.
You've been listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Our senior producer, Ron Petrovich, our associate producer and phone screener, Audrey Castletine, our technical director, Andy Brownell. Our theme music was written and performed by Chip Davis of Mannheim Steamroller. For Mayo Clinic Radio and Dr. Anthony Windebank, I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McRae.
Thanks for being with us.
Any medical information conveyed during this program is not intended as a substitute for personal medical advice, and you should not take any action before consulting a healthcare professional. For more information, please go to our website, radio.mayoclinic.org. Please join us each week on this station for more of the medical information you want from Mayo Clinic specialists who know.